Welcome to Iteration, a podcast about programming, development, and design. Hi, my name is JP. I'm a software developer at a small analytics startup. And today, as always, I am joined by John. John, how's it going?
Hey, JP. It's going really well. My name is John. I'm a software developer for a home services startup. And you haven't heard from us in a few weeks, so I apologize for that. It's been a little bit of a while, but we've had a little bit going on. I actually just had a baby about 5-6 weeks ago, and so the podcast has been on a little bit of a hiatus while I'm hanging out with the baby and adjusting to all that new life. It's my first baby, which has been the biggest project I've ever shipped in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that is pretty crazy, and I guess like on top of having this whole pandemic thing going on, I can't imagine it being easy to adjust to having a new responsibility in your life that isn't monitoring production at 2 a.m. It's a different kind of responsibility.
It's been a very different responsibility, and it's been, and I've told this to everybody, I think I said this earlier before we started recording, but it's been a so much better than I ever expected, like so much better than I expected, and a little bit worse than I expected at the same time. And actually, this was my pick for today, but I'll just jump into it. The community over at Dev2, I think it's Develop Together is the official name of it, but dev.to has just been like so incredible. I put up this post before I had the baby. I was like, I'm having a baby in 3 weeks, like help. And I just got, I think like 40 thoughtful, complete responses from all kinds of people with tips and tricks. And all that stuff has been so incredibly valuable, not only in like how to deal with my kid, but mostly how to deal with work while having a kid. And that's like maybe a whole podcast episode itself. I don't want to talk about babies too long. That's not what we're here to do. We're talking about software and code. But that community has been an incredible support of just like information and like actual logistics on how to get back to work successfully and balance those two things. It's been a really cool learning experience across so many different ways. And I feel like professionally and personally, it's one of those kind of trial by fires where you come out of it feeling so much better equipped, but also like, man, what the fuck just happened over the last 6 to 8 weeks? It's been so crazy.
Can you give me your like number one hot tip that you would tell any new parent, new father, new mother, like going into, I don't know, adulthood?
Yeah. The tip I'll give that's related to the podcast is like trying to balance work and home as an engineering manager. And I got this from the developer community. Someone said it there who's a fellow engineering manager. And it was, don't focus on writing code. Focus on unblocking your team and making your team as high leverage as possible. So like in the times that I am working, I'm just working on supporting my team and unblocking my team. So it's shifted from me directly writing code, although that's been different this week. But in general, since I've been out on leave and then back with baby juggling that, it's just all about unblocking my team. And just completely pivoted from, you know, my time used to be spent maybe 60% writing code and 40%, you know, unblocking team, coaching team, managing team. But now that's probably at least flipped. It's probably 70% managing team, unblocking team, making them as high leverage as possible, and maybe 30% actually writing code or doing code reviews. So I think it's a season. I think I'll go back to being more of an IC over time, but it's been an incredible hot tip. Like, when I'm working, what's the priority? The priority is leveraging the team, like delegating to the team, assigning the team, unblocking the team. And that's been a huge win for me in this season, for sure. Just to stay sane.
Cool. Yeah. So just to put it out there, we don't have like a topic to go over in this episode, just kind of catching up, chit-chatting. It's been so long since we've done one of these that I think that it's probably going to be super easy to fill a whole episode of just catching up. But I did want to touch up on something you said that is kind of a nice segue into just like this conversation we're having. You know, you hear this a lot from engineering managers and from like tech leads and stuff like that. And it's like, how can I unblock you? And, you know, like in stand-up, daily stand-up, it's always like, what did I do yesterday? What am I doing today? And are there any blockers? And I think it's kind of like a funny thing to hear all the time of like, I'm blocked, or like, oh my God, like, how can I unblock you? It's like a meme between myself and some of my friends in tech, just because it's like this thing that gets said very frequently. And sometimes I'll like say it to like my people who aren't in tech, and they're like, what does that even mean? Like, what do you mean you're blocked? You mean to tell me that you can just say that you're blocked and everyone will drop everything they're doing to make sure that you're not quote unquote unblocked? So what I wanted to ask you was like, what are some of the things that you commonly do maybe as an engineering manager to unblock the engineers that are reporting to you or or to unblock the other engineering managers who are reporting to you.
Yeah. I mean, the boring ones is like access. So for example, someone's trying to configure something on SendGrid or over on Cloudflare and they don't have access. Like that's a very simple blocker to unblock. Or another one that's pretty simple is very commonly documentation. So we'll have some kind of a service object that's a bit tricky or an API endpoint that's a bit weird. The params aren't well documented in the tests. And so then I will go in and actually update the code directly so that we have a better document of the test. So I'll kind of amend their pull request to say like, this was unclear, but now this new test should make it a lot more clear, and or just straight up product documentation. So those are the two that are pretty straightforward. The third is the most hairy, which is blocked by the business team or operations team for some kind of operations dependency, to put it simply. But let's say, for example, you have like those first two that are super straightforward, which is, you know, a straight up, like someone needs access to something and there's a whole category of blocks like that. And then there's the one that's more technical, which is documentation is a common blocker. So they need to understand a service object or an API endpoint or how we're implementing JavaScript in this specific way and how that works. But the third category that I was saying is the most hairy, which is you're blocked by some type of a business problem or complexity, some kind of an operations dependency. And my role is unique in that I can come in as a more senior member of the company and just like cut through the bullshit and be like, okay, what is the thing they actually need to get done? Whose responsibility is it? Because not everything happens with technology. Sometimes there's someone in the world that needs to take an action that's a dependency of our software. And like there needs to be an operational piece connected to that. You're probably super familiar with that with your background at Opendoor. I'm sure that was very operationally intense. Our company is relatively operationally intense as well. And so a very common blocker is going and figuring out that business process, make sure there's a key stakeholder and that like we have the inputs and outputs from that stakeholder and like we can move that forward. So what in your experience, what does blocked mean and what does unblocked mean? Do any of those resonate with you?
Yeah, that's definitely a common blocker is like operation stuff. It's like, oh, we can't launch this feature because so-and-so needs to train agents in such a manner first to let them know that this new feature's like rolling out soon and they have to be aware of that before we can even like turn it on. And so, yeah. You know, commonly we'll like put something behind a feature flag and then it's like, we're blocked by operations, but we can ship it as soon as like we get the go-ahead from so-and-so.
Yeah.
That's a very common blocker. My follow-up question to that is, and I'll give you my opinion too, is like, when do you say that you're blocked? Because sometimes I think it's kind of hard to admit that you're blocked because you're like, well, should I say that I'm blocked? Because really what's going on is that I'm kind of stuck on this problem, but it's not necessarily that I'm blocked by anything other than the fact that I need to hammer at it for a little bit. You know what I mean? And like, my hubris is telling me like, wait a little bit before you ask somebody to pair with you because you definitely don't want to go into like a pair programming session without at least being prepared to be like, of course I tried this and I tried this, yada, yada, yada. So I don't know. Yeah. So to me, like the idea of being blocked is kind of this like weird thing where it's very seldom that I say that I'm blocked in stand-up because I guess at this like small startup that I'm at now, there's not really many operations going on. So
sure.
being blocked is more often than not like, I don't understand Auth0 and I might need to pair with somebody.
Yeah. But that's kind of a documentation shortfall, like in that case sure. of Auth0. And I think that I have the benefit of, you know, we have developers and engineering managers and then me as head of engineering. And so I don't get the blockers that are, I'm confused or just struggling with shipping the feature. That's not the blockers I see, but I'm still shipping code and I do get blocked on those things. But not to be arrogant, but like, I know Rails, I know our JavaScript stack, and I don't really get blocked by our actual framework or technology. I'm very comfortable in Ruby, and if I can conceive of a feature, I can pretty much ship it, especially within this stack. So I don't really get blocked in that way like I used to, of like, man, I'm trying to ship this thing in Vue, and I just can't make it work. And I'm puts in the console everywhere, and this thing's just not working. I've debugged the hell out of this. And you know, I've been in a position for a while where there's no one above me to unblock me. You know, my team supports, obviously, but like ultimately I have to unstick the issues. So this idea of just being blocked by a complex issue is just not an option. But where do I get blocked? I get blocked a lot lately actually by our CI and testing tooling because it's getting more and more complex. Like our whole Heroku auto deploys and I just hate that world of DevOps and I'm bad at it and my team's really good at it. And so sometimes I'll be like, guys, this test won't pass. It's passing locally. What the fuck? Fix the CI. Like, I'm blocked because I can't merge because our CI is not letting me merge. So most of my block, like when I've been blocked in the last couple weeks, it's been very much related to like CI and like underlying technical tooling issues that is just like, or linting, that's, it's right on my machine and it's, yeah, it works on my machine. Oh, fuck, I'm saying it. I can't believe it.
Yeah, I think that's kind of similar with me too, because like there's like definitely a fine line between I'm blocked and look, I just need to spend like half an hour to debug this thing. Like there's like a breaking change in some like external API and I need some time to debug it. So it's, I'm not really blocked in that sense, but like there's an impediment to me like shipping this thing when I said I originally would because of some external factor that I didn't take into consideration.
Yeah. And that external factor is very commonly API limitations. Like a quick example is Stripe. We were trying to roll out the Stripe card issuing so that all of our owners on our platform could have their own credit debit card to like have expenses against their company. And there was just straight up a ton of limitations in that API that were undocumented in Stripe. And I finally like got to an account rep. They're like, oh yeah, you just can't do that on that account type. I'm just like, thanks for putting in your docs, guys. And so, like, I had a, quote, blocker for 3 days while I was trying to hear back from Stripe and figure that out. But ultimately, you know, I think you had something similar with SendGrid. Let's go into that, because we were texting back and forth. And on the subject of blockers and third-party dependencies, what happened with SendGrid, and how did you get it fixed? What's up?
Okay, wow, that's a really good segue and also a hilarious one. And, oh, my blood is just, like, starting to boil thinking about this problem that happened. So a couple days ago, SendGrid had this weird feature that turned on for a subset of users. And I know that it turned on for a subset of users because the first thing I did was I looked on Twitter and I searched for SendGrid and I looked at their mentions to see if anyone was complaining about this thing, which always happens. Like you always find someone else who's like, I'm having the same issue you
and
are.
Honestly, there's a hot tip in there. Like if you're using a third party API dependency, you're having issues, go search Twitter because that's where people are complaining about it.
Exactly. And so what happened is SendGrid, for some reason, and you use SendGrid too, and this didn't happen to you?
No, has not happened.
Okay, so SendGrid turned on this feature but called we have like
fixed,
IP.
We have fixed IP addresses because we use private spaces in Heroku. But anyway, I don't want to spoil the lead there. So what did they do to you?
So they turned on this thing called IP whitelisting or something or other, which basically says that it's an opt-in feature. So as a user of SendGrid, you're basically saying like if your server is accessing the SendGrid API, you have to whitelist the IP address that is making the requests.
Right.
And you know, as a Heroku user, you have a dynamic IP address that constantly changes because yada, yada, yada. So there's like add-ons that let you do things like, I think there's an add-on called like Fixie or something or other like that. Or if you have like private, or if you have private spaces, you can have a static IP. But basically what happens is they turned on this feature for IP whitelisting. But what was really frustrating is that it's an opt-in feature. Like I created a separate account for SendGrid just to test this out to see like, because I don't remember ever turning on IP whitelisting. And so turns out it's this like opt-in feature that you have to specifically say like, yes, turn on IP whitelisting. These are the IPs that I'm whitelisting to make requests to the SendGrid API. But what was really frustrating is that as a user of their API, when I logged into my SendGrid dashboard, it was like not turned on, but it was acting as if it was turned on. So like a temporary fix that I was like able to figure out and was actually confirmed by like customer support. They were like, oh, some people have found that this works. And I was like, I did that and it worked. And then it broke again. So what I had to do was I had to like whitelist some IP addresses to like turn it on. I'm doing air quotes, like to turn on the IP whitelist. Yeah. And then I had to delete that whitelist to say basically like turn it off.
God.
Which is weird because like, so what was happening was
so that's the API feature they turned on, but what's the behavior it was causing? Yeah, that's the question I'm looking for.
So the behavior that it was causing was every request to the SendGrid to like send an email basically was saying that you cannot authenticate. So I was getting 401s basically back to my server saying like you are not your API key. It's as if like you had the wrong API key basically.
Wow.
And I was getting a bunch of 401s. My Sidekick queues got all backed up and there were like dozens of emails that didn't get sent out. Luckily, they were just transactional and it like wasn't a big deal at all. So We do send out a lot of emails in this like app that I work on, but it wasn't like so critical. That being said, it was just very, very frustrating because debugging this like threw kind of like a wrench in my day because I was like, how do I even begin?
Yeah. When you're dealing with a like, black box like that, it's so
like,
difficult.
What do you do?
Yeah, what do you do?
And what do you do in production when it's like actually affecting users? Like there's, I was like, oh, this is definitely affecting these users. Yeah. Like, I don't know what to do in that situation other than just like tell the other person that I'm working with, like, hey, we got to sit tight. Emails aren't sending.
Yeah. I will say in projects I've worked on that heavily depend on email, this is actually only one I've done this with. I had two API email providers always hot and ready to go. So we could easily fall back to another if there was any issues. Because like there's outages and it's a thing. And if you have something that's critically dependent on an API provider, and that's why it's great to encapsulate API behavior into service objects, because then you can easily switch out the provider, just plug in a different credentials for a different provider and switch it out. But man, what a bitch. So what was the fix? Like, was it the hack of like doing it through the API and deleting it, or did SendGrid finally get their act together?
They eventually fixed it and it like... So coincidentally, they had like a, if you go on their like status page, I think it's like status.sendgrid.com or sendgrid.com/status or whatever it is. They were all, they had like a thing that said like, oh, we're having authentication issues that are affecting a subset of users. And I subscribed to that. And basically, I was like, I subscribed such that like I would get a text message when that issue was like resolved or whatever. And I just got the text message and it resolved itself. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess it's fixed. And so I went through the whole rigmarole again of like whitelisting myself, deleting the whitelist. And then it worked. That being said, though, like a day or two later after that, the people that some people responded to this like Twitter thread that I was on where I was like complaining with some other guy. He was like, oh, like, why is this feature turned on? All my emails aren't working and everything's broken. And I was like, me too. And then like a day later after everything got resolved, someone else was like, hey, this started happening to me too. What's going on? And then sure enough, at my jobby job, like the same thing happened where SendGrid was just like 401ing, and I was like, what is going on? I don't understand. Like, I don't know, maybe it affected things downstream and yada yada yada, but I don't know. I was able to like debug it every subsequent time that it happened, but like it was just like a nightmare to even begin with.
All this makes me think of is our low code, no code conversation we had, like, I think it was a couple episodes ago, which was now like 1,000 years ago. But just like when you depend on external things, it just makes shit fragile. But at the same time, obviously you shouldn't build everything from scratch. Like there's obviously a ton to be gained by building on top of third party APIs. But man, what a bitch. So, okay, so let's go into some more recent challenges. So you had this whole big annoying thing with SendGrid. I had a recent thing, which was test consistency. So we had this whole thing, and like going back to like CI and tooling issues, we had this issue on our Ruby on Rails app where we had all of our tests, our entire test suite. We have pretty good test coverage. Like, I think we're at 63% as of last check. We were at 90%. Then we shipped a shitload of features without good coverage. And we kind of fell back down to like 50 and we're working our way back up. So we're getting there. But we had this issue where our tests, like every 5 times, would just fail inconsistently. And so that kind of like having to re-pull it down and re-push it to CI and then just like rerun the tests, it was this low-grade fever in our development team that was going on for months. And so everybody had this 5 to 8% efficiency loss that was just flaky tests. And it was a total nightmare. And
what kind of tests? Capybara, integration, unit tests?
So we use mini tests. We use integration tests. We use unit testing. We use model tests. We use all the tests. We love testing. We do tons of different types of tests. So there's API tests, but probably there's like a split between, we basically do what would be called, I don't even know the names, people call these things different things, but you know, we have 2 main classes of tests. There's clicks on, visits, expects page, clicks on this, and it interacts with the golden path as if it's a user using a full feature. I call that a feature test. Other people call that a different thing. What do you call that? An integration test, feature test? What do you call that one? Whereas clicks on, expects page, it's like using the interface.
I just group those as capybara tests. I know that's not what they are,
that's
what you use capybara for.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. And then we have a lot of unit tests, which is really, here's the model, expect, set up a model in a certain state, expect it to have a certain behavior, inputs and outputs, that type of thing, which is more traditional testing that I prefer, to be honest, instead of the other. But I think they're both important. That's a whole conversation. Not trying to get into that. But we had this issue where they were just super inconsistent. And so it was a huge endeavor to try to solve this because it was losing a lot of efficiency, you know, failing every, it was really like 25% of the time they'd fail, which means like you have to, every time you submit a pull request, like refigure it out, rerun it, see if it's you or if it's the CI, and then you can't trust the tests. And that's part of the reason why our test coverage slipped. It's very much like no broken windows kind of a thing where it's like, if you can't trust them, then you don't want to keep writing them. And it's a whole nightmare.
But what kinds of tests were flaky though? Was it the capybara tests, like the Clixon, or was it like unit testing because of like a time, like time copying?
Great question. And that's such a common one, is the time copying one. It was all the capybara tests were super flaky. So number one, we had a problem, which I've seen in other projects where we were not, you know, you have to sign in as an admin, then sign out, then sign in as another user, then sign out and sign, like sign, there's always sign in and sign out and all the setup and teardowns of all these tests, regardless of what framework and what project. If you're doing a complete feature test, you're going to have this kind of a thing. Well, going through our test code, oftentimes developers forgot sign outs. So then it's trying to sign in, and then they're so hard to track down because you have to go through and manually read these tests, find the sign-ins, and see if it signed out. So we added this like test helper to like check if they're signed in and then sign out, which that helped, and that took away a lot of them. But still, so that took it down the vast majority, but it still was going on. And it ended up, because we do a lot of JavaScript on top of Rails using Stimulus, we have JavaScript enabled for the majority of our capybara tests, which makes them a bit slow as a heads up. But then it's like a true feature test because we're checking the JavaScript interactions. But capybara does this thing where it doesn't wait for the page to load. Like it will move to the next thing in a single millisecond. And therefore, there's no JavaScript setup, and therefore, there's missing functionality sometimes. Sometimes capybara waits for the JavaScript. So there was some configuration in the Selenium capybara driver to make sure that the JavaScript all loads properly and those tests go, which is so weird because when we did all that, it actually ended up decreasing our test suite speed by 5 minutes, which is like feels backwards because it's like waiting for the JavaScript to load, but whatever we did in a again, I don't love this kind of like low level tooling stuff. It's not interesting to me. To me, it's like in my way and I don't like it, but the team did a great job of solving this. And it was really interesting to me that it actually brought us from 22 minute test suite to like a 16 minute test suite, which is a huge win. And now they're super consistent. We're getting like 99%, like very consistent tests. Do you have any thoughts?
I think what's happening there is that there's a default timeout for failures, I think, and it will like try to, it'll just keep hammering on it. I know, yeah. You said it will sometimes skip, but like, I think there is a setting there where it will just try to keep running before it eventually times out. And so that's why you cut down on the time, because you're just waiting a specific amount of time and then letting it succeed. And then it proceeds versus like failing and then timing out after like, I don't know, 2 minutes or whatever it is. Dude, truth be told, I haven't written a capybara/feature test in a really long time.
Yeah, so I was wondering, how are you approaching tests lately in Rails, and or I know you're working a lot in Vue, and like how does that work in test environments? So I'm curious kind of what your testing looks like, wherever you want to start on that.
Yeah, so back at like Open Listings when I was working on the Rails stuff, we had like feature tests, capybara tests and stuff like that, and those were they're a bitch.
They're hard to maintain. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And sometimes they're flaky because it's capybara and then on top if you have like time issues, like time cop stuff in your capybara tests, my lord,
but,
it is insane.
But they're such good documentation because it describes exactly how to use a complete feature and how it should work to users. So I really love feature tests or controller tests, whatever you want to call them. That's actually a whole nother category, but feature tests like that, because I feel like every project should have like a good 10% of those, 20% of those golden paths, because you know exactly what users are supposed to do and what the system should do. But keep going, sorry.
Yeah. And I just have like flashbacks of debugging, not only throwing binding pry in my Ruby code, but also throwing a debugger in the JavaScript code, because it was like a front end React app.
So I would do the
use Chrome. It's basically the thing, because you could do like a headless Chrome thing, and you could also do like a Chrome instance
where you watch it click through, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, so I would make sure that it like opens the actual browser, and then I would wait, and then I would let it hit the debugger in JavaScript, and then I would debug the JavaScript in there, and it would be like this
that
whole
is a bitch.
Huge pain in the, and all just so that I could like fucking get like the correct interaction for like a drop down menu, like a JavaScript drop down menu thing, and like a checkbox.
See, that's why
spas
are a bitch. Oh, that sucks.
Yes, but so yeah, so that's, I do think there's value in that though, because you know exactly what a user is supposed to do and how something's supposed to interact. It's great documentation. Yeah. But in Vue, we have tickets like tech debt tickets to start like integration testing our JavaScript a little bit better. Because we have like a spa that's completely decoupled from our API, it's just like our API just has integration tests and unit tests.
Spa, single page app for beginners on this channel,
And our spa has like some semblance of unit tests. Every now and then I'll write like a helper function, and then I'll write unit tests just so that people know what the inputs and outputs are supposed to be. Sure. But like, we don't really have any like Cypress or like any sort of like equivalent Capybara tests. Yeah, it's like not the best. We do a lot of manual QA. Mm-hmm. And on this side project that I have going that I'm like maintaining now, it's literally just all unit tests. And cool. I think that's a good bias though,
especially if you're the only developer. Unit test is a good bias. Yeah.
I've gotten away with doing a lot of unit tests, and I unit test my service objects. So like the test coverage might only be like 60-ish%.
Yeah.
But I want to say that a lot, like I make sure to cover like the really, core features like the mm-hmm. core business logic service objects. I make sure to at least get like golden path as well as like some edge cases that I can think of, and whenever like something happens unexpectedly, then I'll write like a test for that.
Right,
so I only really have unit tests and some controller tests.
Yeah.
Been like zero capybara test that's like on my whatever to do list, but like honestly we've gotten by just fine not having any capybara tests. Maybe if we ever get another developer, I'll start making them write more capybara tests, but like their value right now is just like not there, I guess. I get a lot of value out of unit testing. Do you have any thoughts on that? Is this like blasphemy? I know we've talked so much about
how much you should test. And the thing is everybody on this podcast knows we strongly believe in testing, but I do think there's a time and a place. And I do think when you're the only developer on a project or a key developer on a project, there is a time and a place to cut corners on tests. It can make sense, especially because you're covering your core complex business model. Like at the end of the day, do you really need to test CRUD on all your models? And it's like, maybe not. Maybe you don't need to test CRUD on all your models. I do, but I'm not going to judge you if you don't. I'm going to judge you if you have no test coverage, especially if you've got like a tricky service object. Like, get your shit together, get a test on that tricky service object. But it's funny because I've been thinking of something more lately, which is, we've begun to migrate away from these capybara feature tests in favor of controller tests. Mm. At first, it didn't feel good because we're not actually testing the UI, especially because we do a lot of JavaScript stuff with Stimulus. And it didn't feel good, but at the same time, I'm learning more and more to trust the Stimulus code, like trust the front-end code. And as long as our controller's working, like just keep moving and ship it. And they're way less fragile. Like if you update a single UI button name, it's not going to break all your tests. But the thing I'm struggling with lately still is that we don't like unit test our Stimulus JavaScript code in any way. Like we don't actually test our JavaScript code, but Rails doesn't really have a good way to do that outside of capybara tests. So like there's this weird tension right now where Rails is coming along with a lot more Webpacker and Stimulus, and like it's a lot more JavaScript friendly, but at the same time it doesn't have the JavaScript testing ecosystem. It might. I could just be totally ignorant and totally shooting shit here, but it doesn't feel like there's the same JavaScript testing ecosystem to like unit test my my Stimulus code. I don't know how to test Stimulus code like right.
What are you asserting in your controller tests? Are you asserting that the shape of the JSON is correct, or like are you asserting that the shape of the response is correct? Like what are you asserting in your controller tests that you couldn't assert from a unit test in a service object that is inside of your controller?
Nothing. In reality, we could test the direct form object or the service object directly. There's no reason not to. And it's interesting you say that because in reality, like it's a really strong case for unit tests with a little bit of capybara. When you say that. Yeah, that's interesting. I guess like there is an advantage to it in that you're testing that your UI, when it hits something, will have the service object behavior you're expecting. So it's a little bit of like an interface test, not just a model test. So you kind of like get a win there. My baby's crying. You can hear it in the other room. I hope you can hear it in the podcast, because that's like 10 points for me as like a developer dad.
Yeah, I heard a very, a little bit there. Nice. Like just a tad. Yeah, that's, oh man, that's just so funny. You have a note in here about TDD and how you never kind of took it as seriously.
I never did. So I took TDD. I would love to jump into this topic. I took TDD seriously in two main ways. Number one, when there was a bug, I wrote a test first, replicated the bug, and like wrote code until it's green. So like I set up the failure case and then I fixed the failure case. That way I knew exactly what I was fixing. I didn't have to do all this manual QA to replicate that strange state the user found themselves in. And then at the same time, I know it won't happen again. So I felt very strongly when bug fixing that TDD is the way to go. Or second, if I was like, oh shit, this service object has like 8 side effects I have to keep track of. Like there's a lot going on. Like this single form object or service object is doing a lot. Then I'm like, okay, this is a case where I should TDD. But honestly, like I did a very simple, like a user invite system today. It's like very straightforward. It leans on devise really heavily. This is super straightforward. Our user invite system before, you would select what role you're inviting the user as. And instead of doing that, now I split them into multiple controllers. So it's like you have a specific view for invite an admin and a specific view for invite a business owner. And it's just cleaner for admins. They're not going to give the wrong account type to the wrong person by selecting the wrong button. But in this case, like very straightforward CRUD, very simple objects, leaning on devise heavily, I literally started with tests. And I know I shipped this feature so much faster because you're never clicking around the fucking interface. Honestly, it's a noob move. If you're opening up localhost and clicking around and that's how you start, it's just a noob move, bro. You shouldn't be sitting there manually QAing your shit. You should always manually QA it before you ship it. Like, obviously, there's a place to do it once. But I feel like it's a failure when I sit and click through something 15 times. 30 times, 100, it's such a waste of time to like sign in as an admin. Now sign in as like, come on, let the computer do it. And honestly, I didn't understand this until like new dad, so pressed for time, like needing to ship features so much faster. Like I do not have time for manual QA. Nope, zero. Like my tolerance is now like nothing. I just don't do it.
Wow. You know what's funny about that is I'm kind of there on the same page with you of like when I TDD. Definitely for sure if there's a bug and I'm like, oh, I missed that. And I should probably, if I don't have any tests, now's a good time to put them. Mm-hmm. But I also find myself doing TDD on completely brand new features. Mm. Kind of like what you just, kind of just like what you mentioned right there. Because I had to implement this whole coupon thing and I was like, ugh, this is like, I have to add a couple new models. I have to add a couple new controllers. I have to add a service object that looks very similar to this other service object. And I just started with tests because I was like, well, I could just start writing code, but at least if I write tests, I know that my models are going to be good. I know that I'll know that this service object that I'm writing is going to be good. This was maybe like the first time where I was like, oh, I'll ship this in a couple of weeks. Like, here's a date. Here's a very conservative date. And here is a very optimistic date. Mm-hmm. And I actually hit the optimistic date. I was like, oh, wow, I actually like delivered exactly when I said I would deliver this thing. And I started with tests there. But it's interesting to me because I don't always start with tests. The two times I'll start with tests are completely new features and debugging like an existing like bug that comes up unexpectedly. Yeah. But I find myself not necessarily doing TDD if I need to do a small tweak to something, which is maybe blasphemy to say, but like sometimes you just know exactly what you need to change and it doesn't necessarily warrant TDD. I don't know. Maybe that's probably just me being lazy. In all honesty, that's just me being lazy. But
because you're going to write the test.
Right, yes, exactly.
So, like,
but
here's the thing. If I'm committing as a developer that I want test coverage on everything I ship, why would it be faster to ever write my tests at the end? It literally would never be faster.
Yeah.
And especially because, like, it focuses your work in a way. Like, I'm really a convert on this TDD thing. Like, I hated the idea of red, green, refactor. But, like, you end up shipping shit that's not even in the ticket. Very commonly, I do. Because I get distracted working on other stuff. And, like, I start adding test cases. And it's like, no, here's the 5 test cases I need to cover. They're all red. I'm going to work till they're green. I'm going to submit my PR. And I am like, I'm actually like very much a convert here. And I think that even for little stuff, because like as a developer, I've committed to test coverage. We have a larger, our team is growing. So like we need that test coverage in the system. And it's like, it's never going to be faster writing my test at the end. I don't know of a situation where it would be. Like, come at me. I'm willing to hear it.
No, you're completely right. You know what's funny?
But I think a larger team, like going back to like, if I was on one or two person project, I think it's way cool to be more loosey-goosey. But when you start going to 6-7 developers, like you got to have good coverage. You got to have that stability. It's just, you can't.
No, but the thing is that you go red, green, refactor. I go green, red, green, refactor because I'll write the code and then I'll like write the and then like when I write the tests, I make sure that I can make the test fail just so that like the code that I just wrote.
But that's extra time to go make your test fail.
Yeah, I know.
I do the same thing. But what's worse, like nothing is worse than having a feature done and know you're done and like you're hung up on getting the test to pass. That's the worst case situation to be in. In my mind, like the client wants the feature, stakeholder wants the feature. I know it's done, but my tests aren't passing or I haven't finished my tests. Like I never want to be in that state again. And I love the, like you mentioned, having a deadline and having your test cases, you know exactly what's left to do. And like it's almost like pseudocode, those test cases. Once you get good at writing them, it's almost like pseudocode in a way that is very, very productive, I've found. Yeah. Okay, so we're still on like recent challenges. Do you have anything that's been tough on you lately?
I guess nothing else that's been like really tough on me lately. I have been sort of like pondering a little bit more about now that I have like an app that I'm managing kind of on the side, I just have these questions that come up. And so I've sort of just been thinking about this idea of like memory consumption. And so a question I wanted to ask you is like, what's a lot of memory for a Rails app to consume? And this kind of just like derailed our conversation entirely, like totally taking like a sharp left turn.
Yeah, no, I love it.
But I was just like, okay, so we're both Heroku users. Yeah. And there's obviously that little graph that says like your memory consumption is at this percentage, depending on whatever dyno you have. That 25% might mean 500 megabytes. It might mean 250 megabytes, whatever. And so my question to you, maybe set of questions, is do you look at that? One, do you look at that? And two, what is a lot of memory? Because, you know, we're Ruby developers and Ruby's so bad at memory allocation and it's very super inefficient, yada, yada. Like you hear all this stuff, right? But what is actually using a lot of memory? Because, you know, we have like storage these days and like RAM these days comes by the terabyte. So like, I don't know. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not the person to ask in terms of like DevOps. I hate all this stuff. But I will say the most memory a Rails app I've been on was consuming was 4 gigabytes and change in like running memory. And your eyes just got big because the normal Rails app, if like you just deploy a skeleton Rails app, it's like 150 megabytes, I think. That's like just a starting like CRUD app. If you just like shipped a Rails 6 app, it's somewhere around there, I think. This depends so heavily on how you're using your controllers, how many users are connected, are you using Action Cable? There's so many questions to ask there. But let's say you've got just a small side project, you're using Action Cable, you're going to start at like 150 to 250 megabytes. That's what I've seen on my projects. Yeah. But I have been on a project that was pushing 4 gigabytes. And so we had to go to the like Heroku XLs, whatever it was. And it's really fucking expensive. The bottom line is there, we just started to split everything into background jobs, everything we possibly could. Before even optimizing the code, it was just getting it out of that main thread and sticking it into background jobs so we could split it across multiple dynos, background job dynos, and not all in the main thread. And then from there, it was continuing to optimize the code. Like there was a lot of shit in that code that made N+1 queries and just ate memory. And like another example is we weren't really killing the Action Cable connections efficiently. So we had all these WebSocket connections open that didn't need to be open, yada, 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 yada. So where we're at now in production for the current main project I work on is 650 megs is where we're running. I feel like that's fine for like how many users we have and how much we're doing with Action Cable and more. And I think like my guide on this, which is like the worst, dumbest guide, is just like, can I run it on one dyno? Like on one performance dyno, and can I run it efficiently? To me, it's like, that's a good spot to be. You know, that's $250 a month and we're running a lot of users and a lot of functionality and it just feels right to me. And honestly, if I can afford that, our company can afford that. So it's just fine. So I tend to leave DevOps, as long as there's plenty of headroom in my Heroku, I let Heroku solve it for us. And in the scale we're at, I think our Heroku bill is $1,200 a month. We could quadruple that, sextuple that, and still be fine. And so, like, we're not going to worry about DevOps until we have to worry about it, and we'll get there. It's a terrible answer. People who do DevOps on this call are probably cringing, but that's where I'm at on it.
Yeah. Okay, so I pulled up a couple apps just for...
yeah, I would love to hear.
Just for comparison. Okay, so I have this app that I made for a friend, like, I think 2 years ago now. It's just a basic CRUD app. There might be, like, 3 endpoints.
Yeah.
There might be, like... 4 total users, and it barely sees the light of the day, right?
Sure.
Basically, it's on a hobby dyno, but just,
oh, nice.
Just so
okay.
That, like, yeah. So that is using about, like you said, like 120 to 150.
Yeah. See, that's like a basic
megabyte. Like, that's unavoidable, right?
Yep.
And I looked at WizTutor because I was like,
I was just going to pull up WizTutor. I was just going
to
pull
WizTutor up. WizTutor has to be consuming so much. And it's actually not consuming as much memory as I thought it was. So... on average, it consumes about 360 megabytes.
It gets a surprising amount of traffic, too. So that's actually pretty damn good. Yeah.
It's not even at... It sometimes peaks over the half gigabyte mark, but it, like, jumps... It, like, the memory allocator, whatever, will reset the dynos,
yada, yada,
yada.
Notably, there's zero WebSockets on WizTutor. It's all REST.
Mm.
So I think that probably is lends itself to that efficiency gain, I would say.
Are there background jobs on WizTutor?
Yes, we do have background jobs, yeah. Ah, shit, I don't know, actually. It might happen all in line, honestly. I think there's background jobs. We have some schedulers that run. I think there's background jobs.
Yeah.
I could look at it. I'm not
and
sure.
Then on the sports betting app that I'm working on right now,
yeah.
It is consuming... Let me pull this up. So I am on the standard 2X professional dynos,
yeah.
And my memory is at an average of 250.
You're doing good. You're doing good, man. But again, no WebSockets, right?
No WebSockets, yeah. About 200 users.
Yeah.
So it's not that many users, but I mean, it's like getting traffic. Like,
no, it's a solid project, yeah. If you've got active like that, yeah, it's a solid side project for sure. Yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah, and honestly, I'm now glad that there's more DevOps specialists on my team. Like, they're starting to talk about Docker and moving to AWS and all this shit. Because, we're projecting where we're on track for user growth, and we're going to see some fat Heroku bills in the next 6 months. So we're starting to think through how we can optimize and whether or not we're going to stand Heroku and what that looks like. But, yeah, interesting question. It's kind of fun to compare megabytes and see what that looks like, our dirty secret. But it doesn't mean your code's bad. If you're consuming a lot of megabytes, it could mean that you have a lot of traffic. It could be a ton of things.
Yeah, so the reason that I even thought about this was because randomly I saw a spike in my memory, and I was like, what the hell is going on? Like, it's
You get hit by a bot.
No, here's what it was. It was I upgraded all my gems, and for whatever reason, upgrading Puma to, like, from 4 to 5, like, saw a huge memory increase. And
oh,
I think it's
funny.
Because of some setting or something like that. So I upgraded from 4.something-something to, like, the latest, which is, like, 5.2.1 or something like that. And then I downgraded back to 4, and then my memory went back down, and I was like, okay, I'll worry about that for some other time.
Wow, that's fascinating. I don't know if I've seen that spike in Puma or if we're running that update. I bet we're running that update because we really push Rails Edge. Like, we always update alongside Rails every time. We always push Rails Edge. So we probably have that Puma update, and that might be affecting our memory as well. Okay, I have a question. I'm hard right. I don't know. I'm moving the podcast again. I want to know, how have you seen successful feature handoff to end users and or stakeholders? This is something that's like a constant pain point in my past and in current projects, which is like, this is the story of my life. I get a stakeholder that's all mad that XYZ doesn't exist. And then I'm like, it works. And I'm like, it's here. It's been in the product for 2 months, 3 months, like, and I record a loom and send it to them. And then a month later, I get another angry stakeholder. Why doesn't XYZ feature exist? I'm like, here's the loom I sent a month ago. Here's the link to the product documentation. It's in the feature. So obviously there's a UX problem. Like, obviously, I want to call that out. There's a UX experience design problem. You shouldn't need docs. You shouldn't need a loom video telling you something exists. This is commonly like internal featuring admin tools more than anything else. But sometimes it's user-facing. I'll be honest, sometimes it's user-facing. How have you seen or experience been exposed to successful workflows in like handoff of features, especially to internal stakeholders? Any thoughts there?
Ooh, that is a good question. Yeah, I think sometimes that comes in the form of, hey, this thing doesn't work as expected. And my answer to that usually is, oh, I didn't know that it was supposed to
work,
like,
that
function
way.
That way.
Yeah.
let's figure out a way. I guess now we have to work on that. Like, yeah. That's like kind of the end of the conversation to me. It's like, oh, we didn't realize that this was supposed to,
like,
you
that's
know,
how you
happen
were
this
using
way.
It. Right.
Right, yeah, like, there's just some kind of, like, miscommunication here.
Yeah.
You know, that hasn't happened that frequently in the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 months, I would say.
Okay.
I think I try to nip that in the bud by asking a lot of questions up front and asking a lot, or, like, providing a lot of looms along
sure,
the way.
Sure.
But there are times where that does come up where it's like, hey, this thing is missing. And it's kind of just like, well, how was I supposed to know that this is a missing functionality of this thing that I shipped? Like,
yeah.
Like I didn't know that. And it's usually
that's a little bit of a different issue, though, which is, like, what exists in platform has a different expectation than internal stakeholders would expect, which is definitely something we can talk through. But what I'm saying is, like, it's actually there exactly the way they want. They just don't know it's there. Like, they just don't know to click on the three dots. And like I said, it might just be UX problems. But I feel like I hand over the same features to internal teams. And, like, in my previous days, like, clients would be like, why can't I schedule SMSs? And it's like, you can. It's been in product. It's right in front of your face. Like, this exists. Like, have you ever experienced anything like that?
Yes. When I was working for companies where it was larger than 5 people.
Right.
Because now I work with one other person on this like side project that I passively manage, and then my company right now is like 5 people. So I'm typically delivering exactly what is asked of me and nothing more, nothing less.
Yeah.
And so it typically tends to hit the mark. Where I did experience that was sort of like when I was at Open Door, and it's like, oh, we shipped this feature, but then, like, it goes downstream and there's, like, you know, it's like 3 users removed and they're like, how come I can't send an SMS, or, like, how come I can't, like, schedule this thing? And it's like, you can, it's, you just need to do this and this, or, like,
you can toggle
the feature, but, like, you're seeing the feature. I've had to explain to people that the thing that they want to see is, like, the thing that they're looking at.
It's the,
like,
thing that they're looking at. And
you're,
I just,
looking,
like,
at it right here.
I feel like the question I'm asking is, like, how do I solve for user stupidity? Which is the shitty, arrogant way to ask this question. But again, like, it comes back to UX. But I have to take responsibility for my design, for my feature, for my platform, especially to, like, my team. But I feel like my team loses sight of what the capabilities of our platform are. This user invites thing is actually an example of it. They were having people go manually sign up when they could just trigger the sign up from the admin back end. And, like, I've handed off this doc. I've recorded the same loom 5 times in the last year. Like, you can just invite users. You don't have to have them go to the sign up screen. And so, like, that kind of stuff, I feel like I don't know how I can better. I think it's UX. I think it's a user experience problem. And I think it's about, when I'm saying it out loud, it's helping me understand it, because I think it's about treating internal admin users like first class citizens of the app. Like, take the time to build out the features with similar design patterns and similar discoverability as I would an end user. Because I have this instinct to be more lazy when shipping admin features and, like, hide it behind a hamburger menu or just, like, not be very clear with the language or navigation. I think that's probably the underlying problem that's creating these symptoms. Does that resonate at all?
It does, yeah. I mean, I think at the end of the day, you're not going to satisfy everybody, which
sure.
is kind of a sucky thing.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't know. I think because at the places I'm currently at, the design is very specific, and I don't have to worry about users that are, like, 5 or 6 levels past the user that I'm catering to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, I'm already meeting expectations, and there's not going to be any surprises, because there's no users after them that are going to, like, potentially be confused.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so because there's, like, very specific mocks and very specific direction, I'm fortunate enough that, like, expectations are met. Now, when expectations aren't met is, like, when they made an assumption on how something should work, and then they're like, ah, I didn't realize that this thing was confusing. But it's because, like, users are potentially complaining to them, and then they're like, oh, I was wrong. We need to like design this thing differently. It never comes back to me as like, how come this feature doesn't exist? It's like, oh, we fucked up, and now we need to redesign this thing, so you have to re-implement. You know what I mean? It's very much waterfall, which is what I'm describing, but like, yeah, that's kind of what it is.
Yeah, fascinating, fascinating. Super interesting. All right, we have reached way too long on this podcast. I hope you guys are still around. Let's move into some picks and wrap things up. What do you say, JP?
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, these like off the cuff ones just kind of
they're
just
too
go
fun.
On.
Yeah, we just haven't caught up enough. So my pick, I kind of called it out earlier, is dev.to, dev.to. It's just an awesome little community, just people posting interesting articles and questions. It's kind of like Medium just for developers, and people just post stuff and upvote. It's like a cross between Medium and Reddit just for developers, and I've been loving it. I've been posting a bunch over there and reading a bunch of stuff, and it's a great little community. It's actually a big community, but that's my pick for the week. I would strongly encourage you to check it out, make an account there, go read some good shit. That's my pick.
Yes, cool. I love reading blogs on dev.to because like it's just very specific. Like, you know, you're getting an engineering blog and yep, not some like random Medium. I don't know.
And it hasn't been like taken over by the like sponsored posts yet either. Yep. Where it's like, this is not what it was. It's like back to the roots. Cause I feel like every community gets ruined at some point by big business, and like Reddit's starting to get ruined and lots of those other communities are getting ruined, and Medium's definitely ruined with their fucking paywall. Screw those guys.
Yep. So my pick is
yep.
My pick is this build pack called Gem Malik. I don't know how to pronounce it. There's this the way that Ruby manages memory is through this thing called, I don't know how to pronounce it. Is it I know it stands for like allocate, like memory allocation. Yeah. And I think it's abbreviated to Malik, Mallock. Yeah. I could be butchering that. So you know how everyone bitches about how slow Ruby is and how bad its memory management is and yada, 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 sure, and its garbage collection, this and that. Well, there is this gem called J.E. Malik, and I think the dude who wrote it, I think his initials are J.E. And basically what it is it's a more efficient way for Ruby to manage its memory. And so you can like build your whole Rails application with it, and you can do it locally by installing the gem and compiling Ruby so that it uses that as its memory allocator instead of like the built-in one. But to implement it on Heroku is super, super easy. You just need this Heroku build pack. So you can just, you know, the Heroku DevOps person that I am, you can literally just go into your settings and then add the build pack without writing any code or going into the command line, and that's it. And it just kind of like works for you. This is my pick because I've read a lot of good things about it. Now, have I seen huge memory like improvements? Couldn't really tell you yet. The improvements are so minuscule, and that might just be because that I wasn't consuming an abundance of memory to begin with. Like, I'm sure there's like only so much that you can improve
on. Yeah, there's probably specific cases where it really helps, I would imagine.
Right. Like, if you're using 6 gigabytes of memory, maybe that's when. But I do notice that when I look at my memory usage, that it's definitely like cycling through the memory a lot quicker. Like, it's definitely garbage collecting a lot faster than it used to, I think. So I think it's like potentially maybe using memory more efficiently.
Huh.
I liked it because it was like really easy, and I didn't have to like add any, like I didn't have to write any code for me to get this like win.
Yeah.
And it seems so far to be doing what it's promising to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. Anyways, that's my pick.
Very cool. That's a great pick. I feel like just throwing it in production for my current project and seeing what it does. I'm like very curious, like do it over a weekend and see if it has an impact. I wonder what the gotchas are, because like with things like this, it sounds like in your project you haven't had any gotchas, but usually there's edge cases. Like if it was really just magic halving your memory allocation, it would be in Ruby core. Like it will be. Like,
yeah.
So maybe it will be, and maybe you're just ahead of the curve on that. But yeah, there's a couple links here you put, like how we halved our memory consumption in Rails with Gemalloc. That sounds great. I'll have to check it out. Super cool pick.
Yep. All right. Well, that about wraps us up, I think, right?
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for listening. We are back to our regular cadence of recording every 2 weeks, so you should hear us from us quasi-weekly, and we're excited to be back. Thanks so much for hanging around off the break, and we will see you on the next episode.
Peace.
Peace.